Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be looking at the runners and riders in the Tory leadership race, the latest development in the Trump-Russia brouhaha, and the British woman who might be about to win Wimbledon. First up, speculation about who might be the next Prime Minister has abounded in Westminster since Theresa May's disastrous election showing last month. And as her potential successors start to put feelers out, we are already seeing an attempt to block the route of a certain flaxen-haired former editor of this magazine. The Stop Boris campaign is in full swing, says James Forsyth in the magazine this week, and he joins me now, along with Harry Mount, to discuss an increasingly bitter contest. So James, you write in your piece this week about the plots against Boris ahead of a Tory leadership contest. When do you expect that leadership contest to take place?
I think all of us are slightly more wary of making predictions than we used to be. The default answer to when Theresa May goes, is the end of when the Article 50 deal is done. So sometime between autumn 2018 and March 2019. But in the last couple of days, I've definitely picked up more concern among the party hierarchy that she can't make it that long. But that is simply too long a slog for her to go on for. I think the sensible thing for her to do would be at conference to announce a timetable of when she's going to leave. I think that would buy her some time. People say, oh, that weakens the Prime Minister's position. Well, her position's already pretty weak. And I think it would put the burden of proof onto those who want to get rid of her sooner rather than later.
Harry, why are people plotting against Boris? You're a great Boris fan. Yeah. Can you see that they have a point?
A lot of MPs have always been very envious of him, I think, his fame. He's, you know, the one MP that transcends the House of Commons to become a sort of celeb. They're envious of that. And then quite a lot of the time, when he was editor of The Spectator, MPs would submit their staggeringly boring pieces on, you know, wither the euro, and they were amazed that their piece didn't get in. So part of it was envy. I think also, as James says in his excellent piece, he can't really be bothered to glad hand people and go out on the terrace and have drinks with people. He's got a very low boredom threshold, so he hasn't been buttering up MPs for years the way that George Osborne used to. And thus, as we all know, when he had that spectacular bottling out moment after the referendum, Linton Crosby told him he didn't have the numbers. He doesn't have the same support among MPs as he has among the public at large.
James, do you think he actually wants to be Conservative leader? Do you think he wants to have another go, given everything went so spectacularly wrong last summer?
I think this is one of the fascinating questions. I remember when he dropped out after Michael Gove kind of jilted him at the altar, one ally of his was just furious with me, and just as he stormed out of the launch, he just said he wouldn't stoop to pick up the crown. And there was a sense that, you know, why didn't he want to fight? And then, at the moment, some of the reason why some grandees think that you could do a deal where Boris Johnson, Amber Rudd, Philip Hammond and David Davis all agree to support David Davis is that they think that Boris is kind of ambivalent about the job. And if he could be persuaded that backing David Davis was the best way to kind of safeguard Brexit, which is Boris's legacy at the moment, then he might be able to do it. But I do think Boris and power is not uncomplicated. People want to think that he schemes all the time to be Prime Minister, but he only backed Brexit because he wanted to be Prime Minister. I don't think it is quite like that. I think he has a sense of wanting to get to the top of the cursus honorum, but I think he also, at the same time, doesn't quite have that ruthlessness to power that perhaps you need to make it all the way to Downing Street.
Harry, do you think Boris has the skills to be Conservative leader? He certainly has the charisma that Theresa May was shown to be lacking during the election campaign, but there's a lot more to it than that. There's the ability to keep your eye on policy detail. There's the ability also to manage to make Tory MPs, who are a bit like teenagers in terms of wanting to feel loved the whole time, to feel as though they're being paid enough attention. Can he do that?
Well, he's very unusual, isn't he? Because I do think I'm a fan of his, very, very clever. And he is also extremely ambitious. The famous quote, when asked what he wanted to do when he was 5 years old, when he grew up, he thought about it for a while and said, world king. So he's got that massive ambition. And then he has these sudden moments, and I think he had one after the referendum, where he gets struck by the same black dog that struck his hero, Winston Churchill, and suddenly has these weird moments of lack of confidence for someone who's normally so confident. He's also, for someone who's so popular and jokey and friendly and good at talking to people, he's a bit of a loner. And so I think sometimes some of these things won't go very well with being Prime Minister. But I do think at the same time, he sees it as his manifest destiny at some level.
And James, just give us an idea of who else wants to go for the Conservative leadership. It might be easier if you just tell us who doesn't, yes, given everyone seems to be in the frame at the moment.
Our producer Nick said he only wants us to last 12 minutes. I think there is a huge number of people, and I think this stems from three things. The first is that this is a chance to be Prime Minister without having to go to a general election. The kind of keys of Downing Street are being dangled in front of people.
So there's no prospect of another election?
I think they will avoid it. I think the Tory party are just determined not to go back to the country.
We did say that this time last year, though, didn't we?
Yes, no, indeed. But I don't think they're going to be 24 points ahead in the polls again any time soon. I think the second thing is a sense that, you know, if Theresa May can be Prime Minister, so can I. And then people look at the other people putting themselves forward as candidates and think, why not? And then I think the third thing is just simply the volatility of politics at the moment. There is a sense that, why not? You know, who'd have thought Donald Trump would end up as President of the United States? You know, so why not go for it? I think that all that is going on. I think Harry touched on a very important point about Boris and the Black Dog. I mean, I'm told he's getting up at 5:30 a.m. not just to read the papers online, but to read the comments about him below the line. And I think
why would you do that?
I know, indeed. I mean, that might explain why he is finding it hard to kind of recover that kind of joie de vivre, you know, that ability to cheer everyone up that used to be so integral to the brand. I think in a way he does need to deal with that. You know, I know he was very shaken after the referendum when he started getting kind of abuse on the streets of Islington as he cycled around. I mean, I think he's like the Queen Mother. He wants to be loved and he isn't comfortable with not being loved.
Surely that will make life very difficult for him as Prime Minister, Harry, because part of being a responsible Prime Minister is taking unpopular decisions which people get annoyed with you about and sticking by them rather than just folding and wanting everyone to be happy. I mean, you can't possibly do that at any time, but certainly not following Brexit negotiations, certainly not when you still have a deficit to cut.
I think that's right. I think James is right. He loves being popular. That's one of the reasons for the constant jokes, as well as being funny. He's longing to actually make the jokes in order to get the confirmation of popularity in the laugh, but actually he has dialed down the comedy off over the last year or so. That's why he's been a bit more absent than normal. But you would have thought if he's going to dial down the comedy, he'd dial up the seriousness. And that disastrous Eddie Mayer interview, which you refer to in your piece, seems extraordinary because he is, contrary to his public image, very hard working, getting up at 5:30 in the morning, doing absolutely everything. When I used to work with him on the Telegraph, he'd be writing the leader at the Spectator, putting the Spectator to bed, writing his GQ column, car column, preparing, I think, Michael Howard for Prime Minister's questions, just packing a huge amount into a day. And he's dropped a lot of those things. He's dropped the Shakespeare biography, hasn't he? So you would have thought he'd have been much better prepared for that Eddie Mayer interview. I thought that was extraordinary.
I always thought it was extraordinary to go and do an interview so unprepared with a journalist who he knows dislikes him. I mean, Eddie Mayer was the person who called him a nasty piece of work when he went on the Mar show when Eddie Mayer was standing in. I always think the danger is that it gives credence to these, I think, unfair reports. I mean, a cabinet minister who has no particular dog in this fight says that if you were going around the cabinet table, Boris's contributions are some of the most impressive in that he's clearly read his departmental brief but isn't just regurgitating it. You know, some people haven't read their departmental briefs, some people regurgitate. He's one of the few cabinet ministers who is taking it, tweaking it. But when he performs as badly as he did in that Eddie Mayer interview, when people go around telling impressionable Tory MPs, oh God, you should see him in cabinet or he's an embarrassment at these international meetings, that somehow seems more credible than it actually is.
And James, you avoided saying who you thought, who else you thought was going to be in the leadership contest. So I'm going to press you again on some of the most credible names.
So if Theresa May was to go before 2019, I think David Davis would be the front runner on the grounds that as the Brexit secretary, he would run as the kind of person who could hit the ground running straight away. His supporters kind of liken him to De Gaulle solving the Algerian problem. He's the person who can say je vous ai compris to the Brexiteers. I think if it is after 2019, then the case for David Davis is far less strong. I think in that case, you would see Amber Rudd stand. I think you'll see Priti Patel, Andrea Leadsom, Dominic Raab, Jeremy Hunt, Justin Greening, Sajid Javid, George Freeman, who have I not said? I mean, the list could go. I'm sure I have missed out several of them. It's like an Oscars acceptance speech. There's always someone you've forgotten. And obviously the question of whether Boris himself would throw his hat into the ring. I think again, all this volatility is making more and more people think they should go for it, along with the fact that all the candidates are flawed. And that means that everyone thinks, well, they're not perfect, so maybe it could be me.
Harry, who would you tip, aside from Boris?
I do think, and I'm biased, I do like him very much. He's in a league above. He's just more amusing and interesting. I'd have thought David Davis is the favourite, but we'll remember that 2005 speech he gave against Cameron, and it was sort of lazy and badly prepared. I suppose he is the obvious alternative. But I still think Boris has been written off so many times, had more comebacks than Frank Sinatra. He's even written himself off. I heard that on the day before he was appointed as Foreign Secretary, he told a close friend, "That's it, I'm over in politics. I'm going to go back to journalism and writing books." And so I think there's always one last chance for Boris.
I remember years and years ago, when I first became political editor of Spectator, I took out someone who knows the Tory party as well as anyone, but he'd also worked with Boris for supper. And I was saying, "Oh, what do you think about Boris? Will he ever be Prime Minister?" When Boris was in his first term as Mayor of London. So as I said, the Tory party will only ever turn to Boris when it's 3-0 down with 15 minutes to go. And by 2019, the Tory party could be at least 3 goals down with 15 minutes to go. And I think it is that sense. If they feel that they need something special or magical, because the Labour, Jeremy Corbyn seems inevitably set on reaching number 10, that is Boris's best chance.
Thank you, James and Harry.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
Next up, it feels like forever since the first rumblings of inappropriate contact between the Trump camp and Russia. But this week, we've heard perhaps the most substantive noise so far. Donald Trump Jr., the president's big game hunting eldest son, has been caught up in a leaked email thread that could tie him to the Putin administration. But is the evidence actually rather thin? Paul Wood considers this in the magazine this week, and he joins me now along with Freddie Gray. So Paul, who is Rob Goldstone, and how has he come to find himself embroiled in a scandal that once again apparently threatens the presidency of Donald Trump?
Yes, wouldn't it be ironic if the president of the United States was brought down by two Brits, one of course being Christopher Steele, the former MI6 spy and Russia expert who published his now famous dossier on allegations that Trump was being blackmailed by the Kremlin. And now we have Rob Goldstone, who is, as I write in the piece this week, one of those eccentric minor characters which sometimes pop up in political scandals or crises. And if you look at his Facebook and his Twitter, it's just fantastic. This is a man who clearly, let's say, is at home in Trump world with the glitz, the glamour, the brashness, the vulgarity. And as such, was chosen, according to his own emails, as the rather unlikely go-between the Russians, perhaps Russians connected to the Kremlin, and the Trump campaign.
Freddie, what is Goldstone's relationship with Russia? How has he ended up being this go-between?
Well, he represented a Russian billionaire called Aras Agalarov.
Well, actually, he represents the son, Emin, whose father is...
who's the pop star.
What somebody derisively described to me as a minor oligarch, but still rich enough to pay for his son's pop music career, which I suppose the unkind critics would say hasn't been terribly successful. But when your father's a billionaire, he can buy you the stage and buy you the publicity and buy you a Rob Goldstone to promote you.
And buy you positive Donald Trump tweets. If you go back through Trump's Twitter history, he said, you know, really think we can build a Trump Tower in Moscow to this minor oligarch. And then at the end put, as for Emin, the pop star, wow, exclamation mark.
Not only the tweets, actually. If you look up on YouTube, Emin Agalarov and Donald Trump, you'll see that after Trump was elected, when you think he'd have really other things to worry about, he sent a sort of bizarre exchange of messages with Emin Agalarov, both congratulating each other. You're the best. No, you're the best. It's right there on YouTube.
But I think the interesting thing about this story is like all these Trump-Russia stories, the first time you read it, the first time you see it, you think, God, wow, that's serious. And then after about a day or so, the sort of dust settles and people say, well, is it that bad? Now, does this mean we've just become accustomed to the horror of Trump? Or does it mean that actually there really isn't that much of a scandal there? And I mean, I think Donald Trump Jr. this time has been directly implicated in trying to get evidence in a means that would be illegal. And as Paul says in his piece, there's plenty of people who weren't aware of the law who are now in jail having breached it. But is it more a case that actually this terrible collusion between the Russian government and Trump is actually just a case of a very strange PR man in Britain trying to put the eccentric Trump family with a very minor oligarch in Russia?
Paul, do you agree with Freddie that some of the reaction to this story and previous ones has been over the top and that it fades as people actually realise what the reality of the story seems to be?
That was certainly the argument of Donald Trump Jr., who appeared on Hannity last night, Fox News show, which is pretty much a mouthpiece for the Trump right in America. It's a big nothing burger, is their argument. Look, I met this woman and actually nothing came out of it. There are several problems with this defence. First of all, attempting to collude, or the critics would have it, conspire with a foreign power and an adversary of the United States, and simply failing because you're not much good at it, isn't a great defence in politics, certainly if not in law. Secondly, this meeting undoes 6 months of White House explanations that there never were any meetings sought by the campaign, that none took place, and that the assessment, united assessment of the US intelligence community, that Russian state interfered in the election to help Donald Trump, was politically motivated nonsense. And here you have Donald Jr. Accepting this meeting on the basis that here's the Russian state trying to help. And it's really a question of what more is out there. If the New York Times has this, and they can only have got it from the intelligence community, what more is there to be leaked out? This is not going away. I think it's only going to get worse for the Trump White House.
That's interesting, Paul. You say they could only have got it from the intelligence community, because there's quite a few rumours that it might have actually come from the White House.
I suppose it could have come from the White House, a disloyal official in the White House, but he or she would have had to have got it from the intelligence community in the first place, unless we are back to Donald Trump's speculation about a 400-pound man sitting in his bedroom hacking away. Or in this case, the 400-pound man, or the 300-pound man, to be accurate, is Rob Goldstone, introducing a lawyer from Moscow, apparently connected to the Kremlin. So I suppose it's a distinction without much of an important difference, either an official briefed by the intelligence community or members of the intelligence community themselves. And really, what more's in the files? That's the important question. Are we going to see an end to this? Nobody imagines that.
But there's quite a good conspiracy nonetheless, quite a coherent conspiracy theory, that actually this story could end up being something of a nothing burger. Donald Trump Jr. will take the fall, may even have to go to jail over it.
What's a nothing burger?
Well, a nothing burger means, it's Chris Christie's phrase, I think, or certainly he used it quite promptly recently, means it's sort of a seemingly big thing that amounts to nothing in the end. And I think the coherent conspiracy theory about this is that this is Trump's way of inoculating himself. Donnie takes the fall, little Donnie, who's not very popular among Trump's closest advisors. And actually, it removes Trump from the equation. It may not play out that way. But it's odd that the New York Times should have this story now. And I wonder if there's something in the idea that this leak came from the White House and not intelligence officials, as Paul says.
Trump does have a long history of ringing up journalists. There was briefing against his chief of staff, Rentz Priebus, to journalists in Washington. And it appeared, according to the media here in Washington, D.C. anyway, that it was Trump himself briefing against his own chief of staff. In the 1990s, he had the habit of ringing up journalists in New York, pretending to be a PR man and pretending to leak details about which glamorous women Trump had slept with. And then people noticed really the voice was quite similar to Trump himself.
It's quite a distinctive voice, isn't it?
It's quite a distinctive voice. Yeah, I don't know how he thought he'd get away with it. But you have to remember two things. First of all, nothing we know about Donald Trump's personality suggests he thinks strategically. He gets up in the morning and reacts. That's how he's always done it. And that's how he appears to be behaving now. There's no evidence of strategic thinking. Secondly, for the last 10 or 15 years in business, anybody who's looked at his businesses carefully have said he's basically acting as the brand ambassador. He's the guy who goes on TV, shoots his mouth off on Twitter, and the actual deal-making and negotiating in detail is done by the kids. So Donald Jr. would be behaving politically exactly as he's said to have behaved in business. And at the end of the day, he's family. I can't imagine that Donald Trump would serve up his own son in this fashion. None of this makes any sense. But, you know, stranger things have happened in this White House, this presidency, in this campaign. So who knows?
And Freddie, you have written in a number of pieces that there is developing a real obsession with Trump's Russia links. Do you think that's going to continue? And do you think it's actually worth the Democrats and the liberal media's time in the way that they're expending their effort at the moment?
I think in a sense it's a worthy obsession, certainly for journalists, because, I mean, as Paul has done some brilliant work on this, and I wouldn't ever say he's been wasting his time. I think there's something there, and if it can be proven, it's a huge conspiracy bigger than Watergate. So it's worth journalists doing. I do think the Democrats have got hung up on it to the extent that they don't actually bother opposing Trump properly in any other way. They don't form coherent responses to his pretty disastrous healthcare plans, for instance. And that the opposition to Trump is effectively the media and the Russia story. It's not a coherent political response to a political phenomenon that has shaken American politics to its core.
Paul, what's the reaction like to this in America?
I don't think in the heartland, among Trump supporters, anybody gives a fig about Russia. He goes around still having these Make America Great rallies. They're still well attended. His core support, every time he's criticised by the liberal media, I think his supporters just like that. And in fact, it seems to be a deliberate strategy of the Republican Party in general to campaign against the media. The media are treated as the official opposition, and to be fair to them, looking at some of the coverage, sometimes the media behaves like the official opposition. But this isn't just a political process, it's a legal process. There is a slow, plodding, grinding, thorough, remorseless FBI investigation headed by a special counsel, Robert Mueller, former head of the FBI. And that's going to look for evidence of law-breaking. And if it finds evidence of law-breaking, it's going to report that, it's going to act on that. And then the politics will be transformed by the legal situation, exactly as happened under other scandals, such as the impeachment proceedings that President Clinton faced. There's a legal and political track, and they both affect each other.
Freddie, do you think this could be the ultimately the end of the Trump presidency?
At the moment, I don't see how this smoking gun, I think it's more dramatic perhaps than any other Russia scandal or element of the Russia crisis, Trump-Russia crisis so far. But at the moment, I don't see how it's grounds for impeachment. And I think people are maybe jumping the smoking gun, as it were, perhaps a little too soon.
And Paul, what do you make of that?
Oh, this is a long process. Most people looking at the FBI investigation think it'll take another couple of years before they've done the groundwork. Nobody should expect the US Marshals to be kicking in doors at dawn in Trump Tower. And it really depends, I suppose, when you come to impeachment, on the politics of this, because the Republicans have a majority in Congress. Many of them don't like the Trump administration, don't like President Trump, but they're sticking with him while his numbers are high. But if the Democrats win the House in 2018, if Trump's numbers drop, then you will see that the politics in Congress amplifying what happens in the legal process and vice versa, and all bets are off.
Thank you, Paul and Freddie. And if you want more like this, tune in to our Americano podcast hosted by Freddie.
Why wait for tomorrow's papers? The best analysis of the day's news is already on Coffee House. To subscribe to the Evening Blend email in order to receive the best of The Spectator each day, just head to spectator.co.uk/blend.
And finally, every summer, Britain becomes momentarily captivated by the green lawns of SW19. This year, with Andy Murray's shock quarterfinal defeat, British hopes rest with semi-finalist Joanna Konter. So who is she? And given she's Australian-born to Hungarian parents, can we really claim her as our own? Simon Barnes writes on national sporting identity in this week's magazine, and he joins me now. So Simon, how good is Joanna Konter? Is she the best British woman in tennis in years, or is she just capitalising on the absence of strong competition?
I've been watching her for some time, and I've been increasingly impressed. The reason she's taken us by surprise is that she's a classic late developer. She had the shots, but she didn't have the head to make the most of the talent she's got. She acquired these laboriously and rather self-consciously through means of mental training and life coaches and that sort of thing. The sort of thing we all kind of like to sneer at and say it's not real. But in fact, with her, it's absolutely struck the chord. She's organised herself and she has that ability to withdraw in a slightly zen-like fashion from the points and the state of the match, and to come close to what is every ball player's aim, and that is to play the damn ball when it gets there. She had a very good run at the Australian Open the previous year and didn't follow through to make a good Wimbledon, because we're British, we're only tennis fans for a fortnight every year. And so we thought, well, maybe she wasn't all that much. And so this has taken us by surprise. Not me. I was pretty confident that she would have a half-decent Wimbledon. And she's gone on to do rather better than that. Yes, yeah, sure. The women's game has got no very clear and established dominance hierarchy at the moment, particularly as the Queen, Serena, is away from tennis having a baby at the moment. So it's open for them as wanted, and perhaps to establish a hegemony over the women's game is a vacancy that's available to one that might take it. That's getting rather ahead of ourselves. I'm kind of interested as whether she's going to win the next match.
And in terms of the mental training, I saw an interview with her the other day where she spent a lot of time talking about muffins. They seem to have been quite important in her development as a tennis player as well as a cook.
Yes, I think it's because she is an intensely private person and has the strength of mind to keep that so. She doesn't actually tease us by letting little bits slip out here and there. So basically, we as journos don't have very much to work on. I had a breakfast meeting with her last year and she was absolutely tremendous, very intelligent, vital, full of intelligence and thoughtful mind. She didn't just go through the notion of answering the questions as in form and avoiding anything difficult as people are trained to do with me. She answered the questions properly. But on the other hand, I knew that there were absolutely walls of adamant there. If I were to say, "And tell me about your boyfriend," she would say, "No, I'm not, and the meeting is at an end," because you know, she has a right to do that, and that's how she's chosen to play it. So what she does let out, then people tend to jump on, and she let out something on social media saying that she baked some muffins. She's got a new flat in Putney, and so she's obviously trying it out and trying a bit of domesticity for size, and finding it quite good fun, and good on her for doing that. Apparently she's going to try banana muffins next. Wish I could have one.
And you say that the Brits only really are tennis fans for a few weeks in the middle of the summer when Wimbledon's on. Are they Joanna Konta fans? Has she become part of British tennis culture in the same way that other top players such as Tim Henman, who everyone used to go loopy over for a few weeks until he then lost when he was at the top of his game?
Yeah, she's in serious danger of becoming so, I have to say. The quarterfinal, which was on Tuesday night, was just a classic piece of tennis. Lost the first set on a tiebreaker, might have lost the second set on a tiebreaker. She was 3-1 down. Then she came back and showed all the strength. And then she had what it takes to strike the ball cleanly and hit winners right at the time when it really counted. Now, that goes straight to the pleasure centres of the people who like watching sport, people who like watching tennis on television. It showed not only that she's a good tennis player, but that there's a lot about her. There's a bit about her. There really is some strength of character that you can admire there. You say, you know, she showed that she was, you know, a fighter, as we like to say. And yeah, we admire that. That's fun. So we know that when it comes to whatever the next match we see her in, we know she's not going to roll over. We know she's going to fight. She knows she's going to give us something worth shouting for, worth caring about. So yes, she is in serious danger of becoming a national favourite, a new national treasure, as our favourite phrase is.
And your Spectator piece this week is about the notion of nationality in sport and how that's quite difficult to pin down sometimes. And to what extent is Joanna Konta a British player? She obviously qualifies for LTA funding, but she's not originally from Britain, and she moved to Britain as a tennis player, didn't she?
Yes, indeed she did. She was born in Sydney, Australia, to Hungarian parents, and lived there until she was 14. And then she went to the Sanchez Casal Academy in Barcelona. Andy Murray went there. That was his own kind of great step on when he decided he wasn't going to train just with his brother. He wanted to put himself out to be the best he possibly could be. Joanna Konta made the same decision, and good on her for doing that. Meanwhile, her parents moved to Eastbourne, and Konta became a British citizen in 2012. I don't know what's British and what is not. Look at the England cricket team at the moment. Who is the more qualified to play for the England cricket team? Keaton Jennings, who is a fair-haired lad who was born in South Africa and played for South Africa under-19s. Or Moeen Ali, who was born in Birmingham, whose grandfather is from Kashmir and who wears a great Islamic beard, or a W.G. Grace beard, if you prefer. They both play for England, and Moeen Ali took 10 wickets, so perhaps worth cheering for. It's a very complex business, and it's one of those personal frontiers to a large extent. Me, I'll cheer for Joe Konta all day, and for Moeen Ali as well.
But could it be the case, Simon, that actually nationality or Britishness can be determined according to whether you have money and mobility? Because I suppose sports people like Joanna Konta, like some of the cricket players, actually have been able to move to this country because they're part of, perhaps we might even call them a global sporting elite, who are able to move where the funding and where the best opportunities are.
Yeah, and then again, there is Mo Farah, who was a Somali refugee, who has done the double-double of winning gold medals at 5,000 and 10,000 metres for Great Britain at the London Olympic Games, and one of the greatest nights of sport in British history. And then he did the double again in Rio. Yeah, it's a very complicated world. It's very easy to get on an aeroplane and to be somewhere else. Nationality is no longer a fixed and obvious thing as it used to be. The old certainties have gone. in sport, we love certainty. We love to cheer for our own. But who is our own? That's something that changes from day to day.
Thank you, Simon. And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, our religion podcast, where this week Damien Thompson is discussing a feud between the Pope and one of his most influential cardinals. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on the podcast, as well as great pieces by Andrew Marr, Hugo Rifkind and Dominic Cummings. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners, 12 issues for £12 and a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/podoffer. Thanks for listening and do join us again next week.